Hello there, and welcome to the Thinky Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Adam Francisco, and Scott Keith. This is our first episode after being back from Here We Still Stand. So we recorded a couple episodes of Here We Still Stand, the live show, which has been out for a couple weeks now. And then we recorded two more episodes sort of in a back room while we were there with various guests that we wouldn't usually have an opportunity to get on the show. But we're back to our sort of our normal hosts this week and our normal system. It's not as exciting as being in front of the live crowd. That's a fun episode, but it's definitely different being on a panel. This was the same case in Norway because we don't always take pictures of the studio, but we all face each other around a table here during normal conversation, and so you can sort of look around and see if the next person's going to talk or something like that. And when you're on those panel discussions, you cannot see each other really unless you bend over the table and you look. So you kind of have to pray that somebody's going to answer the next question or tell a story or something like that. And both times it's gone fairly well. And it's just different, and it's nice and comfortable to be back in the studio, at least for me.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys feel the same, but it's definitely a different format when you have like the strict panel questions.
Yeah, I'm just still tired from Here We Still Stand.
Yeah. It's like that one time a year, it's exhausting, but it's also you try to do as much as you can because there's just so many people you don't get to see or talk to.
Yep.
Regularly. And that's outside of the talks, that's my favorite part of it, honestly, is just the people I get to spend time with who I don't get to spend time with regularly in the year.
And how many denominations are represented? Way beyond us.
Several, yeah. There's only about 100 tickets left for next year if people want to sign up.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So that's a much faster sellout rate than last year. Yeah. So if you're thinking about it, I guess that means now is the time to buy tickets. I'll put the link in the show notes for registration. Like I said, the talks are great. I think it's worth it to come for the talks, but the fellowship, it sounds sort of cheesy, but is better, is the best part of the conference, at least for me, and I think it is for a lot of people. It becomes worth the trip. It is sort of like a vacation. It's
nice.
It's at a nice setting, a nice hotel, and it's definitely different than your sort of academic theological conferences, that's for sure. And I don't know. I think I have a good time. I suggest if you haven't been to Here We Still Stand, that is, I would start thinking about it now because it might take some planning, especially if you don't live locally in California. You got to buy plane tickets. You got to, you know, book a hotel room, all those sorts of things. So
step one is get your ticket.
Yeah. Might have to schedule in-laws to watch kiddos or something like that. You know, I do think you should consider it. So moving on to today's episode, I want to talk about something I think we've talked a lot about recently, but I want to go from a different approach. I want to talk about the importance of historical methodology and why is it not only important to Christianity, which I think we should get around to in this episode, because it is, but in general, why is it important? What is it? Are there various methodologies? Is there any debate over what methodology is the right one to use? And how does it relate to people sort of in everyday life? That's sort of a general way of throwing it out there. But maybe, Adam, you could start by just explaining or what is a historical methodology?
Yeah, we got an in-house expert.
Well, I don't know if
you're talking about Adam.
It depends what you're wanting to do, you know, in your history. But generally speaking, in describing the past, you work inductively from pieces of evidence, mostly primary source texts. Nowadays, depending on what you're looking at, sometimes that includes archaeological evidence and so on and so forth. You put all those pieces of evidence and you reason to the best explanation of or you write your narrative, you describe the past such that it accounts for all that evidence without leaving stuff out or assuming certain things to be true that aren't necessarily there. I mean, that's the gold standard. You could say that historians work with a correspondence theory of truth. That, I mean, a coherent narrative is certainly nice.
Sure.
But the real measure of a good description of the past is whether your description actually links up to the or corresponds to the evidence that we have.
Yeah, so that means there may be gaps or things like that if something wasn't recorded, right?
Sure.
And so you have to be careful about sort of inferring or filling those in, or if you do, sort of letting people know where the evidence stops and where sort of your narrative begins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the other thing that I notice in the study of it, that there's a whole gang of people who say, now, of course, anything miraculous you can't introduce.
Right.
It's an a priori. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This, of course, we don't cover that sort of thing as if it's religious or something.
Yeah, I would suggest that, the best historians are out there are the ones who don't assume certain metaphysical...
Right.
Things, to use an accurate term.
No, right. Don't
assume that just because in their lifetime they haven't observed something supernatural, if you will, that that doesn't mean there isn't a supernatural. Those things are to be avoided. We at the University of Oxford, I had to take a course in what's called historiography, which is kind of the methodology of writing down history. And we were reading the Venerable Bede, his history of the church and among the English-speaking peoples, and I think, he's 8th century. Lived in Northumbria, northeastern England. I don't think he ever left the village
he lived in,
but had access to an outstanding library, and he's still, in many ways, kind of for medieval historiography, the gold standard. And at the... In the seminar on Bede, one of the questions that was proposed or asked by the tutor, a guy named Henry Meyer Harding, who was, I believe, a queen-appointed professor of church history.
Okay.
So he's no slouch. And we're in his office space. He's got medieval tapestries hanging from the walls, and it's very...
Oxfordian.
Yeah. It's like what you might imagine goes on at in a tutor's office at Oxford. But... He asked us what we all made of the miraculous in Bede's account of the history, and I didn't answer. but one of my peers was quick to answer and said, "Well, he's medieval. Their worldview is filled with the supernatural, so of course they're gullible and they believe all these events can be explained by appealing to supernatural causes and so on and so forth." And this pretty serious, sophisticated historians looked at him and said, "You're such a modernist." He says, "What makes you think you can rule out a miracle?"
Oh, that's awesome.
You're a historian. You're supposed to go with the evidence.
That's awesome.
So even at places like Oxford, the real serious critical historians can sniff out somebody who smuggles in a metaphysical dogma like miracles don't happen, like the resurrection.
Yep.
And they'll call their colleagues out on it.
Mm-hmm. That's good to know, huh?
Yeah, encouraging. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying there's a whole lot of them.
Yeah, of course.
There are some.
Of course.
Well, that's important to sort of the outside inquiry towards religious study, even then. I mean, it sort of stops even Christians from ruling out other religions just offhand.
Right.
All right.
So I run into this a lot with regard to Islam. Because in the biography of Muhammad, there's lots of accounts of miracles.
Isn't the major one the one about the moon coming in and passing through both these sleeves, but it was so fast that nobody could see it?
Well, nobody was around to see it, even. Okay. So, Muhammad looks at the night sky, and he's looking for a kind of confirmation of his so-called prophethood, and the moon falls in or gets split in half. Half of it falls out of the sky, goes in one sleeve, around his back, and out the other. Other great miracles when he was born.
That's an odd miracle. Like, what's the point
of
the moon splitting in half and going through his sleeves?
To confirm in Muhammad's mind that he was a prophet, because he wrestled with that for the first 2 or 3 years of his so-called call to prophethood. But another one, when he was born, his mother, Amina, as he's coming out of the birth canal... a light also comes out and illuminates the whole globe. You get these things like that. And in the context, if I'm speaking with Muslims, they will be very quick to point out that I hold Islam to a different standard than Christianity. And my response is something like what you said, Scott. I said, well, I'm not saying these miracles didn't happen, but if there's nobody around to see them, and if they're just, they don't really speak to any sort of human need or anything like that, they're kind of inconsequential. So, well, whether they happen or not, who cares?
Well, the miracles in, in Christianity seem to be history altering in almost every, right? So even the miracles of Jesus healing people, that alters some sort of thing in permanent space and time. It's not a miracle that happens and then it ends, like the moon coming down and then going back up right to where it was.
Mm-hmm.
It actually alters something permanently.
Yeah. There are critical Muslim scholars, we don't need to beat the Islamic drum here, but who make the point that those miraculous accounts were actually written into the biography as apologetic devices. Because when Islam starts to gain momentum, they're rubbing up against Jews and Christians who are asking, well, why should we believe you if there's no miracles?
Yep.
And so they put them in there. Mm. But you can't rule out the supernatural claims in other religions. That's
right.
But the interesting thing is, if you look at other religions and these supernatural claims, unlike Christianity, where you can, I mean, there's archaeological evidence, there's so much overwhelming evidence for this. Other religions, they're just claims somebody made in the past. And that's as far as it goes.
They're just assertions.
Yeah, yeah. There's not an eyewitness tradition. It doesn't change or affect history the way it does with Christianity. So you got to be open to them. That doesn't mean you need to take them seriously.
Yep.
So, in removed from religion, is it important that we know that certain things or certain people actually existed if the ideas are still present? So, is it important that we know that Plato was a real person if the ideas which are attributed to him are, relevant?
Well, it'd be upsetting if he wasn't a real person, but the ideas would still live. And that's the difference, again, the difference, and we talk quite a bit about this on the show, the difference with Christianity is it all falls apart.
Yep.
If certain things didn't happen.
Well, if certain assertions are not true, it falls apart. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In 1 Corinthians 15, if you can show that his bones are in some tomb, Christianity falls. Mm-hmm.
So I guess unlike a philosophy, Christianity doesn't matter if that writer was the actual writer. Because with philosophy, it's those ideas exist and have now been interpreted and passed down. But Christianity is more than the sum of its ideas. It's actually contingent on something happening or existing.
Yeah, it can be factually overthrown. And you ask somebody from another religion, is there any factual state of affairs which, if it actually prevailed, would cause you to change religions? And many will instantly say no. And unfortunately, some Christians answer that when they're present in a philosophy class. Is there anything that would cause you not to believe in Jesus?
Or in a televised public debate.
Yo.
Yeah. That one you always feel bad for, because it seems like the heart was in the right place, right?
Yep.
He's trying to do the right thing.
He just got caught.
Yeah. He's trying to make it so other Christians don't doubt.
Conundrum.
Right? And that's a hard position to be in, but we talk about that debate a lot. It might be worth it. I've never put it in the show notes before. It might be worth it to put in the show notes so people could see an example of apologetics done apart from this historical methodology, I guess. Because that one's actually pretty fair. It was a public debate, and there it is. We didn't reference it directly, but for those who don't know, this was Bill Nye, the Science Guy, and Ken Ham,
the creationist, essentially.
From the creation, the Creation Institute is who he...
Answers in Genesis.
And and they sort of had a televised debate. It's interesting because, Bill Nye is not a real science guy.
Right.
He plays one on TV, but, when you have...
Is that true? Is that funny?
Yes. It is true.
I didn't know that was true.
So when you have writers and money and staff, though, you can prepare for a debate. You don't have to be a science guy to have a debate about science. And it's long. It's like almost 2 hours or something like that. It's long. But at the very end, Bill Nye gets Ken Ham, essentially. Mm-hmm. Is there any factual state of affairs that would cause you to be in disbelief?
Yep.
And he just plainly says, no, there's nothing that'll change my mind.
Yep.
Which... even in a debate setting, is that's admitting that you're not even there to debate, you're there to evangelize. essentially. That the ideas weren't even up for discussion in the first place.
And it betrays not really an understanding of even the New Testament text. 1 Corinthians 15 is an extended argument, particularly about Jesus' resurrection. Mm-hmm. And Paul says, if this did not happen, we are of all men most to be pitied. We're worshiping something that's false.
I do want to point out, though, that I don't think that that sort of mentality is unique to Christianity or religion, even. I mean, I've seen this with historical events where, like, you know, somebody questions maybe the preciseness of our recording of some battle in the past or something like that, but it's then announced to be universal fact, well known, or something like that. That's the same thing. Is there anything that could make you believe that the Napoleonic Wars didn't happen?
Yeah.
If you say no to that,
yep.
you're not doing honest history, are you?
Adam, you said at the outset that doing history is an inductive method. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, we could get a little more technical. It's actually more abductive. But just we're looking at individual pieces of evidence, or you look at individual pieces of evidence and you infer to the best explanation for all that evidence. Rather than the deductive approach, where you assume something to be true in the first place, and then you look at all the facts and you put all the facts into this kind of almost Procrustean bed, and describe whatever it is you're looking at that way.
It's fine in math.
That's where it works. Math yeah. and that almost perfect science geometry.
Yeah.
It is, in fact, perfect, I think. Plato thought so. So yeah, that's the big difference. Historians don't assume something to be true in the first place, and then go look at evidence.
Yeah.
If you're doing like history from the ground up.
Yeah.
Another, you mentioned the was it the Napoleonic Wars or?
I just tried to throw out some example
that's
there.
That's pretty recent, and there's no reason to think that they didn't happen.
But I think in past episodes we've said there's doubt about things like landing on the moon. The details of 9/11, I mean, as recent as,
sure,
you know, is in the 2000s, is, yep. Yep. You know, doubted or at least joked about as.
Oh, so it's the explanation of those events. It's nobody denies that the
correct.
Two towers
it's
fell.
The
and it's
cause.
Like, you know, mm-hmm. The cause of all that.
So, especially in the case of 9/11.
Yeah.
I've used this before, but I think it's worth repeating. When I was in doctoral work in philosophy at USC, somebody came in and interrupted Dallas Willard's lecture. You don't do that unless it's your wife was killed in a car accident. You don't do it. So when the guy left, Dr. Willard looked at all of us and said, okay, let's stop this lecture. The flat earthers are outside. See if any of you can make any traction against them. The ones who are defending that the earth is like a plate, not like an orange.
Killed the flat earther.
No, I'm not.
You mentioned, mentioning Napoleon again. There is this interesting fellow in the 19th century named Richard Whately, who was a Christian apologist. Craig Parton's written a biography and also included the text of one of his more famous apologetic works in there called Historic Doubts Relative to Napoleon Bonaparte.
Yep.
Oh. And what he does in that work is shows, because this is the age of higher criticism, right? He takes the method and assumptions of higher criticism that was used to discredit the biblical text or the historicity of the biblical text and applies it to all the literature available for Napoleon Bonaparte from both the British and the French side and concludes, just following their basic methodology, that maybe Napoleon didn't exist. The problem was he was writing at the time when Napoleon was still alive. It was just that you had bias on the British were anti-Napoleon, the French were pro-Napoleon. And so there, you really couldn't trust anything and so on and so forth.
Good illustration.
When I first brought that up, you said, that's pretty recent history. Is there a distinction in the trustworthiness of something that is recent versus something that is ancient? And how does one make sort of a deciding line? What is the line there?
I guess there's kind of two lines. One is you want to have, for like a professional historian, you want some historical distance and not just in terms of a timeline, but also in terms of
influence.
Emotional effect and so on, between your subject and yourself. And that's different for every person. But the big basically the rule is the further back you go, the harder and the less you know.
Isn't that a lot more true? Cool. Mostly because of the availability of text to study.
Yeah. So, let's think. If you look at the history of the Roman emperors, you know, the first in the first century, let's say, you've got basically two pretty solid Roman historians accounting for those Roman emperors, Suetonius and Tacitus, and they're writing early second century. Several decades, but not too long after the New Testament authors. Nobody really questions whether Suetonius or Tacitus, whether the material we have from them has been reliably transmitted, and that whether it's, there are things that people squabble about, but the general narrative people agree to. The interesting thing is we have less than 200 manuscripts of Tacitus and Suetonius, and the time span between when they actually wrote the first autograph, the first manuscript, to when we actually have manuscripts is at least 800 years. And that's the way it goes with most ancient figures and events and texts, but it's very different with the biblical tradition.
But that's
extremely
different. That's why it makes it harder with older events.
So over that 800 years, we have a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy however many times it was re-recorded.
Well, so they're writing in the second decade of the first century.
No, it's even worse than that. Right? Yeah. You don't have a copy that you can date until 800 years after they supposedly wrote.
Yeah.
It's not like you have this bridge of copies.
That's how you got the text.
200. Yeah.
People copying it, but those intermediate manuscripts have all gone missing.
Yeah.
It's hard to preserve a manuscript, especially in kind of humid Europe.
Yeah. So then there are things that, could have been changed, might have been changed.
To be sure.
Yeah.
If you look at the New Testament, we have an overwhelming amount of evidence that what we have, what's in your translation, your good one-for-one translation, like the NASB or ESV or what have you, and I'm going to debate these little finer points, but it's an accurate reflection of what the New Testament authors originally wrote. And then we've got a whole bunch of Greek and Coptic and Latin and a whole bunch of other translations of manuscripts, up to almost 30,000 of them.
Yeah.
And the time frame between when they were originally written and when we have the earliest manuscripts, it's not a settled issue, but it's less than a century.
Yep.
There's nothing like that in the ancient world.
Yeah, that's right. There's nothing like that in the ancient world. If you're skeptical of the New Testament text, you ought to be really skeptical of the writings of the ancients.
Yeah, you should throw away your knowledge of the ancient world, basically. Yeah. Plato and Aristotle. And,
and you can't trust the historical narrative that you learned in school about Rome or Greece or what those events actually played out to be.
Now, we should add that just because you've been taught a certain historical narrative about Rome or the Middle Ages or whatever, it doesn't necessarily mean that's right. I mean, one of the whole points of the historian's profession is looking at the narratives we have to see if they missed something or if there was bias there, And so history is always, it's not always changing. The past isn't changed.
It's an empirical endeavor.
Yeah, it's always, we're always, at least the gold standard is, we're always trying to get closer and closer to what everything we've got from the past. So sometimes there's new discoveries.
Yep.
Sometimes
that's what PhD theses are about.
Exactly. That's exactly what they're about. I mean, you get now the big trend in real history in universities is people combing through archives.
Well, and
looking at baptismal registries, drudgery type work, seeing, doing, looking at the rates, how many children were baptized in 1492.
10 years ago, it was people just trudging their way through correspondence. Instead of reading
letters,
published works, you're just combing through an individual's letters to the various people through it.
Yeah.
It'd be like somebody, 500 years from now looking through your email archive.
Right.
And trying to get a picture of who you are.
Right.
Could you imagine
this person was a consumer, is what you would...
Yeah. I mean, that's what it was. And I've heard now, too, it's like we would call them public records type of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Even when I was back in college, just going to the University of Washington, everybody knew, or should have known, that if you get into the history department, there are a whole bunch of Marxists who have made a metaphysical judgment over everything.
Yeah.
If you found one who wasn't operating from a priori of Marxism, you would have found a rare treasure. And that was back, 50, 70 years ago.
Now it's in all the humanities. It's infected all the humanities and other departments. I mean, that's unfortunately. But there are those who fight the good fight and resist that. But again, it is like a diamond in the rough when you find one. When you find a person like me.
This was happening when we let him talk this way.
I've gone to historians because I'm desperate to fill in an accurate record of U.S. history.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that is different from what all our kids have to read by Zinn. I finally sort of settled on the Brit Johnson.
Yeah, Paul Johnson.
Paul Johnson. I'll try that.
Yeah, he's excellent.
To get an accurate picture of American history.
Yeah, and so, I mean, speaking of American history, I mean, there's, if you go to Barnes & Noble or whatever, you're going to see hundreds and hundreds of texts, history of America. And they're all going to, I mean, because it's such a massive, we're talking over 200 years, right? They're going to, historians will always decide kind of how they're going to approach history. Are they going to approach it through the history of ideas or social history, the history of institutions, economic history, military history, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, it's a complicated thing, and it gets even more complicated when you consider, well, what sources do you use? Because you mentioned, Scott, a bit ago, there's published sources, then there's like personal correspondence, archives. In American history, there's this great... we use this reader at Concordia University that has mostly published works, but every once in a while throw in a diary entry or something,
which helps
fill in our knowledge of everyday life.
Anything that you might have an opinion about, because when I'm doing this, I'm usually trying to discern what somebody taught, right? So what did Luther teach on X? What did Melanchthon teach on X?
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of the low-hanging fruit is to find... if they ever addressed said topic in their published works.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right? Next step is to see, like, are there any unpublished manuscripts where they talked about X here? But then all you're really doing is seeing the stuff that they threw out, right? That they maybe said it, but it obviously didn't make it to publishing. They didn't think it was good enough to make it to publishing. And now we start looking at their correspondence and I think there's a danger to some of this, that you end up getting what people thought as they were working on an idea.
Yeah, like conversations we have might not, if we were talking about a book or an episode before it goes live, some things, get scrapped before they make it on air.
Mm-hmm. And somebody might say, though, you're going to get what they really thought if you can get what they wrote to their best friend in a letter. And you're like, well... you might get what they were really spitballing if they get what they wrote to their best friend in a letter and what they really thought after they had time to think about it and edit it and put it into a published work.
Yeah, you can get the heat of the moment.
It's hard because all of this comes into play, especially in this kind of history of ideas, right? As you're sort of trying to trace the evolution of somebody's thought on a particular topic, especially people that are known for having wise thoughts on particular topics.
Yeah, you think of somebody like the late Adler, and he would be the one who would represent, I'm going to try to teach you faithfully the history of ideas as they were presented by their best representatives. If you can find somebody like that in history, study under that guy.
Yeah,
I've seen this presented and was taught it actually by Simeon Zoll, the retrieval of certain theological, but this would apply for historical ideas or things can't be used universally. So, for instance, in our chapter on the friendship between Luther and Melanchthon in Where Two or Three Are Gathered, I used letters between Melanchthon and Luther, but I quote unquote retrieved those in order to get a picture of what their friendship was like, not necessarily what a particular theological issue was right, like, right? So you're retrieving that for a particular use that those documents are more in line with than, say, trying to get their Luther's doctrine of justification out of those letters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all I'm trying to say is that this is, it's a careful task, and it's one that we've sort of in our modern conversations have lost track of how careful it is and how many factors there are that play in. Now, you can go two ways with that. You can say there's so many variables involved with studying the stuff that you really can't know much of anything at all, right? Mm-hmm. Or you can kind of get definitive and say, well, this means, of course, you can know exactly X, Y, or Z. And I think Adam, the way Adam described it is good, and I think we more of us should think of it this way, that you do your best, right? You do your best with the data that's available to you, and you make the fewest number of assumptions, and when you make an assertion, you sort of give the reason why you're making said assertion with the understanding that it's, I wouldn't say up for debate, but I'll say it's open to further investigation on the thing.
Always is. Yeah.
And that would be so helpful in the modern theological conversation, just to you know, stop thinking that just because we've made an assertion that it's definitive. I mean, it's absolutely definitive, and that it's not up for further investigation, or that our sources need only be limited to the sources that will confirm the assertion that's already been given. You know, and some of this is just not helpful. And this is just basic, in a lot of ways. We've done so many shows on epistemology. This is what this is. I mean, you can take this conversation and apply it to many things in life, right?
Right.
How do you know anything about this? Well, you're going to know because you've taken in information from various sources, and you've weighed those sources, and you've leaned on some, and you've discarded others, and as information piles up in one pile, you tend to believe, you know, the thing that pile seems to be asserting.
Well, and sometimes for the sake of fruitful discourse, you have to be aware of and open about that place where you got that information and the conclusion.
There are books. I bought a whole set of them, but it was not the only one, that were designed for a freshman as to what to look for in his field. Even if he didn't have a field yet, that he might be his field. So you have these great historians, for instance, doing how to take history courses, or what to look for. Mm. For instance, I've used this one already. If I'm going to go on in historical studies, I am not going to go to a department where every representative in the department is a Marxist. I'm not going to go to that university, or I'm going to try and find a university where somebody's goal is to tell the truth. That makes sense?
Interesting implications for some things.
Well, it means just being honest. So, like, if you have a proposition that you find yourself arguing, and then somebody says, well, how do you know that? And maybe it is just a gut feeling. Just maybe you lose that argument in that instance, but it's better to admit that it's a gut feeling than to...
Yep.
Sort of keep arguing it. Yeah. And if it is a gut feeling, investigate it further.
Sure.
See if you're right or wrong. I mean,
sure.
This is sort of the...
That kind of openness is at fewer and fewer and fewer American universities. Mm. But it's worth pursuing, so that all that money you're going to borrow has some value when you're done.
I was even in our own broader social circles, you know, that sort of openness and willingness to change your mind.
Seeing less and less of it.
Yeah, it's insane.
And a Christian who's educated, if somebody comes up and says, how do I know you're not just like a Marxist? You've got your Christian take on things. That's a perfect question for a Christian.
Sure is. I mean, have you read outside of your particular system?
Mm-hmm.
Have you considered the alternatives? Have you weighed the evidence?
Mm-hmm.
Have you read the critics? Have you read the people you know, within your own tradition that believe slightly differently than you do,
mm-hmm.
and weighed what their assertions against the ultimate authority, which is Scripture. I mean,
yeah, even if you have a source and norm like Scripture, it's not opposed to those outside ideas then being investigated by Scripture.
Right.
It's just that this is a lot of work.
Yeah,
you know?
A lot of work. Takes a lot of maturity, too.
Think of the historians of the future that are going to have to cull through our Facebook posts and our Twitter feed Instagram.
No. Please don't.
You know, and our email and our text to try to find out what we really think about something.
Good grief.
When I first started doing this, when I first started working on my PhD dissertation, I was, I'd say naively, trying to argue influence, right? And one of the wisest things that was ever said to me is that an argument from influence is essentially a waste of time, right? Because you're always sort of doing this comparative analysis, trying to figure out who had what idea first, weighing in the balance, and that it's a very difficult thing to ever come to a conclusion on, right? Yep. You can almost only ever get to the point of, well, it seems like, you know. And
think of C.S. Lewis when he wrote in one of his books, The Value of Psychological Arguments.
Right.
And what he said and delivered to us was, none of them can be definitive. You have got to have different grounds if you're trying to argue that something is true.
Right.
A psychological argument is not adequate. Know it from the beginning. It's not.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't know why I said that.
Well.
Anyway, I had to change. Essentially, what I'm saying is I had to change to something that had better epistemological groundwork, you know, something that you could sort of rely on. And what you in history, what you land on is what the person said.
Yep.
Did they say, especially if you're talking about the history of ideas, what did they say on said topic?
Yep.
Not what was their motive, who was in their ear telling them what to say.
Yep.
And that's what they actually said.
And that's what we've pointed out on past episodes, and just to relate it, because, I mean, some people know what your doctorate was about and some people don't. That's one of the reasons we've done so many episodes on Melanchthon, because a lot of Melanchthon, you know, quote unquote scholarship has been about his motivations
and not
what he actually wrote, but why he wrote it.
Yeah.
And that's where the problems sort of get is when people
and who influenced him to write it.
Right.
I mean, everybody from John Calvin to
he knew everybody.
Instead of analyzing the piece of writing itself.
You know, Luther once said of historians that they're the most useful of all people because they alone tell the truth.
You know, I've heard you say that a couple times.
I've never seen you
cite it. You usually are smiling from ear to ear when
but
you
a little,
say it.
One more thing, throw you a bone. Melanchthon once quoted Cicero, who said, "Those who don't know their history forever remain children."
Yep.
Yes.
I don't know why I throw that in, but
no, that's a very
since we're kind of
comment.
Panning out.
Well, it sounded like an ending quote, but I sort of have one more thing to...
That would have been great.
That would have been a good one. You can say it again. How about that? But part of this, too, is like your system of trust of where you get your information from, too. So if somebody told me and said, Adam said that Luther was a heretic... I'd sit here and go, I'd look at them and say, that doesn't sound like Adam, something Adam would say. Where did he say it? Where did he
How many beers did he have?
Yeah,
was it followed by a gif in the text?
But I guess my point is I wouldn't be willing to say Adam would never say something like that. I'd be open to somebody showing me an instance where you said that any one of us at this table could be wrong. And I think we've tried to do that over the years, in especially the early episodes where we gave massive we did a whole episode with a bibliography of over 150 sources, books.
And I often freely admit that I was wrong once.
Yes, that's true. And so I think the point of all of that is to encourage people to continue their education, to not just stop here. And the fact of the matter is, if you continue in reading these things that we claim to have read and are regurgitating the information out of on this show, you might email us in and say...
I think you overcalled that.
Yes. And that would be... I mean, that's a fair thing to do. It's an inquiry that we are open to on this show as not sort of being the end-all, be-all authorities... But trying to have a conversation, and unfortunately with a podcast, it's a one-way conversation with people at home that encourage them to continue this this endeavor.
Yep.
And I think that's why we do so many epistemology episodes as well. Well,
you could probably notice it when we do shows where we discuss other positions and how sort of nervous we are.
Yeah, we try to be careful.
And the caveats we give and sort of say, oh, I'm open to being corrected on this because I yes. am. I've read a fair amount of Calvin, but I'm open to being corrected on my sort of impressions of Calvin.
Yeah, I issued a correction on Twitter, not on the show, but I overshot the gap between the publication of the Institutes and Luther's sort of beginning reforms on episode by several years.
Six years.
Yeah, and I just wanted to be like, hey, look, I was shooting from the hip, and I made it sound like there was a larger gap than there was, or something like that.
That's good illustration.
It's it's an instance where sort of like I don't think that the point I was trying to get across was misplaced, but the data I used to support that point wasn't entirely correct.
One that interests me in this field is that Calvin originally signed the Augsburg Confession.
It was very widely accepted. I just said that in my class on Sunday morning, that we attribute a lot of sort of the firestorm of Lutheranism to early Lutheran works by Luther, which is fair. But we often leave out the firestorm in favor of the Reformation to catch up in greater Europe, Western Europe, shall we say, to the publication of the Augsburg Confession and the political support of the publication of the Augsburg Confession.
Right.
And how that helped the ideas of the Reformation gain foothold, not just theologically, but politically in other portions of Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, one of my favorite contemporary historians is Niall Ferguson, spelled Niall.
Okay.
He writes broadly. He's an economic historian, but he makes the point. He talks about intellectual history, the history of ideas. He says, that's all well and good, but the way ideas are passed on is through institutions. And so it is, like you said, the politicians in the political people
in the sort of post-industrial history, economic historians are becoming more and more sort of the go-to people on the transmission of not only ideas, but things, right?
Yeah.
The things that change history in particular areas.
Hmm. Yeah, like the church, political institutions, and like the
railroads.
Augsburg. That's an institution of a
communities.
It's not just ideas floating around out there disembodied.
Yeah, you can't become a Christian sort of your own internalness. It has to be transmitted from an outsider to you. Somebody who's a member of this Christian community has to relay that information to you.
Wasn't Ferguson just on that other podcast we listened to?
Jonah Goldberg's? Yeah, a while
about a month ago.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Oh, interesting. Well, hey, guys, we made it to the end of the episode. Adam, I don't know, do you want to repeat your quote? Or you want to end on a fancy...
Historians are the most useful of all people. They alone tell the truth.
There you go. We hope you enjoyed this episode. You can support the show. We need monetary donations in order to keep the show going. So you can support the show by going to 1517.org/donate. We would love to see your support, big or small. In setting up a small recurring donation is one of the easy ways that people can help us who maybe don't have the means to float the whole boat. So
how about instead of a small recurring donation, an affordable
recurring donation. I like that. That's good. That's a good way to say that. So again, and thank you for those people who currently support us. Thank you for those who support us by helping us increase listeners, encouraging others to listen, sharing.
Hey, we haven't told people to go on and rate the show in a while.
We haven't. I forgot about it. But you can go on iTunes. That's the primary place where you can rate it. You can rate it on other avenues like Podcast Addict and and Google Play Store and stuff too. But if you do use iTunes, it'd be helpful to go to the Thinking Fellows page on there, even if you don't use iTunes, to listen to the podcast and to rate the show. I think we have close to 400 ratings on there right now. It'd be cool to get over 500. So
we could have a party.
That would be great. We have
Adam could smoke ribs.
Yeah.
We have many, many, many more than 500 listeners. So if if a good chunk of you could go rate the show, that would be very helpful.
Maybe Adam will smoke some ribs.
And maybe Adam will smoke some ribs if somehow that's relevant.
I'm a master chef.
All right.
Well, thank you for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time.
Bye.